Super well. Welcome to all our POP listeners. So POP is a monthly podcast that highlights and features and amplifies the voices of our Indigenous colleagues here at the University of Alberta and makes room for their hearing about their different and unique contributions. So today, we're happy to have Jackie Bellrose, a returning guest, who will be co-hosting with myself and Kyle Napier. So Jackie, I'll pass it to you. You can introduce yourself in a way that's meaningful to you and introduce our POP guest for today. Welcome.
Thank you. Tanse, Jackie Bellrose, Nsikasan, East Prairie Métis Settlement Utchaniya. I work for the Faculty of Arts. I work for Undergrad Student Services. I'm the Indigenous Engagement and Recruitment Specialist for the Faculty of Arts. And today we have with us one of my good friends and one of the deadliest profs in all of arts, Matthew Wildcat, the one and only.
Awesome. Thanks, Jackie. Yeah, I know we've known each other for 20 years now, right? And you know, we had probably a decade where we didn't see each other, but then when you started working back in the Faculty of Arts, and then I remember, I don't know if you remember this story, but it was a meeting that Skip was having with all the Indigenous like faculty and staff on campus. And I asked the question from the back of the room and you were at it in a different part and you heard me say, I have a question. And you said you had like chills go through your body because you're remembering back to undergrad when I would just ask the tough questions.
I have a question.
Yeah. People all the time.
In classes, I was like, uh-oh. As soon as Matt had a question, I was like, okay, it's going to get interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God. Me and Jackie, we definitely had some interesting experiences in undergrad, but you know, part of, I was thinking about our relationship and kind of getting to know each other in undergrad. And for me in undergrad, that's why like the Faculty of Native Studies was such a cool space at that time, because there was a lot of Indigenous students who were really connected to communities, I would say, right? And like people do that in all sorts of different ways. And I want to get about that a little bit later in this like idea I have of Indigenous density to kind of like think through what it means to be Indigenous. But yeah, let's jump into, you know, today I was hoping that we could talk about intergenerational knowledge, you know, and a lot of it I've been thinking about recently a little bit in response to intergenerational trauma, right? Because it is intergenerational trauma, obviously something that we pass on to each other, but that we try to, you know, people are actively responding to and trying to cut off the ways in which, you know, we continue to harm each other. But for me, a lot of it, I've been thinking about, you know, what makes me Cree, right? And I think also too, what makes me like an a Cree educator or like a, you know, what is Indigenous education, right? And so for me, Indigenous education really is about, we have to build Indigenous institutions where we have the ability to not only just pass on our own ways of knowledge, but to have sites where we build each other up, right? And part of that building up for me is leadership, right? How do we have a steady stream of leaders who are capable of going and building our nations, right? And running our nations. And oftentimes I think part of the disconnect that happens in the university between Indigenous peoples and non-Indigenous peoples is, you know, with a lot of Indigenous faculty, students, staff, these are people who are nation builders, right? And that's a heavy responsibility when you think about it, right? You're like literally in, you know, responsible for helping your nations run. And many of us are in that sort of position. And I think that is actually for many non-Indigenous people is a really tough thing to kind of, for them to wrap their heads around the type of responsibility, you know, that we carry as people who are part of Indigenous communities. And so, you know, with Indigenous, so for me, a big kind of way in which I think of myself as a Cree person is thinking about all this knowledge around leadership that has been, you know, passed on to me, I would say, you know, in particular from my dad, but, you know, also from my aunties and my uncles and my Kokum and Wissam, and, but frankly, just from the entire community of Irminskin Cree Nation, and then to a larger extent, you know, Musqueaches, like that there is a belief around what it means to carry yourself as a leader, right? And so that understanding, I think, it's not leader as visionary, although I think that's part of it, or it's not leader as commander. Really, it's like leader as having a commitment to holding yourself to a certain standard, right? And so to be a leader is to have a certain level of discipline in how you carry yourself in everyday life. And so for me, I think a lot of that teaching was really passed on to me when I was a teenager. And, you know, this idea that like the reputation that you have, that you carry with you, you know, one misstep and you'll unroll years and years of hard work. And so it's on you as an individual to kind of always to carry yourself in that even-handed manner, to treat other people fairly, to like really want to have a clear-eyed understanding or picture of things and be very empathetic to like lots of different perspectives and what lots of people are coming at. But then also I think part of it is your responsibility is it's you're never just listening to others, right? It's part of it is you have to then kind of take a stand yourself on what you believe and what your principles are in a situation, and having a clear-eyed vision of like, okay, what are the goals that people are trying to accomplish here? And then as leaders, how do we get there, right? And doing all of that in the context of being highly disciplined about how you are interacting with others and carrying yourself in your relationship, right? And so, you know, that is, I think, very common in Muskoches, this kind of understanding of like the discipline it takes to be a leader. And so what has been really interesting to me is, as you know, you kind of get that sense of like what is being asked of you as a person. But then when you get to learn the broader history of like how Cree governance worked, that sort of action by individuals was really super important to the whole governance structure, right? Because you needed those people who were capable of acting in that disciplined way all the time, of carrying themselves in a way that was looking out for the group, because those people would attract others. And that's what would allow groups to form and to function well, right? And then when people didn't carry themselves in that sort of way, people then had the ability to leave, right? And that's really what maintained legitimacy in traditional Cree society, is that ability for people to leave when leaders weren't acting in a good way and weren't carrying themselves with the best interests of the group in mind, but also weren't carrying themselves with that kind of that discipline of treating everyone fairly in an even-handed way. And so I think about all these teachings around leadership really as like informing my present day understanding of like what we do as educators, right? Because what we do as educators is partially we have to build stuff, right? We have to build sites of Indigenous education. And we're really only capable of building those sites of Indigenous education if we have those individuals that we trust that, but like, you know what, yes, if resources go to this person, if other people are participating in the work with this person, that they're going to build things, they're going to do really incredible things, right? And so, you know, because I think so many of our institutions are still up in flux, are still being built, you know, I think this kind of this intergenerational knowledge around leadership still has such a vital role to play in Indigenous education for how we build everything up.
Yeah, I have a couple thoughts, actually. Thanks for bringing that topic in terms of really rethinking about leadership from that Cree governance perspective, mm-hmm. and then the discipline that's required. And so there's two things, two wonders that I have. Mm-hmm. Is one is around, yeah, first it's like this idea that you're like, we're as educators, we want to build an Indigenous institution. And so we're never really doing that work kind of in this neoliberal alone model, which somehow can be conflictual or have tensions within the academy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then there's the mentorship part. And I wonder what your thoughts on mentorship and if leaders had the ability to leave, but there would have also been, I would imagine, parameters around leaving.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Like there would have probably been some relational ethics around how the leaving occurred. What did that ability to leave, that autonomy, that sovereignty to leave, but what if you didn't want to leave? You know, like what were the parameters?
Yeah. Well, you know, the way... in which the history books talk about it. And like this, it sounds like this was very, very common across many different Indigenous nations, but you would have your annual cycles, right? Where your groups would get smaller in the winter, you know, to help you survive really. And, but then in the summertime when, you know, you were capable of having much larger encampments and people together, right? And so part of it is that in those summer encampments, because they're so large, you know, it's a little bit easier to leave in a way where everyone saves face, because you're like, you know what, this winter, I'm just going to go spend my time with this other group, right? And so it didn't have to necessarily be a big kind of blowout fight or anything of like, you're awful, I'm leaving. You know, like people kind of were able to do it in like a, in a manner where it was like, a, you know, it didn't always have to be a big thing, I suppose, right? Excuse me. You know, the one thing I do wonder about, and I think this is where there probably is a lot more research to be had, it is around like, you know, what role did gender play in the ability to leave, and like how people kind of like practice their family units and like, you know, kept their family units together. And so, you know, in Kim Anderson's Recognition of Being book, there's these really interesting passages around like, yes, men and, you know, women would have had kind of different like roles and skill sets, but also people had to be responsible to know the other gender's roles and abilities too. Because you, like, let's say if you're out on a trap line, you know, by yourself or just with, you know, maybe say, you know, two men, right? Well, you don't have anyone around but yourselves, so you have to figure everything out. But then exact, you know, the exact same for women, right? You had to know how to hunt. Like women were obviously the ones responsible for putting up teepees and maintaining that home. And now we kind of like, in a weird way, oftentimes it gets associated with something that a man would do in the present day. And so, you know, they're really, I think the kind of the key element of it that is that there was always like lots of overlap in what people's knowledge and what they had to know. But at the same point, you know, this kind of the way in which it gets described of like, you know, you would just leave, you know, after a summer encampment, you would just leave with a different group. And that was facilitated because you would have kinship connections with multiple different peoples, right? You would know, you would have lots of different people that you knew. But I, you know, I wonder about the internal dynamics of families and how they would make those decisions together also, right? And so that's something I feel like I know less about. And I wonder if there's a way to do research on something like that. What was the mentorship question? You know what, the mentorship question for me, I think is really fantastic. And part of what it has to be at the university, within the university settings for Indigenous peoples, but I think this is something where, you know, Indigenous peoples have something to teach the broader university, is like, what are the skill sets that we really value and like promote in the university, right? Well, you know, ultimately publications, right? Like, can you just pump out writings and on certain things, right? And but it, a lot of times, your ability to do that, you're really, it's hard not to imagine a university where there's not a huge value play. Like implicitly, the university places a huge value on the autonomous individual, right? Because it's that individual who needs the space to be able to like hone in, focus, do research, pump up publications, and not be encumbered by a bunch of relational obligations and responsibilities. Right. And but in particular, that person then also has to have a skill set which really values them being alone, right? In a way, and like, you know, doing their work on themselves. And so oftentimes when, you know, the university can, you know, people, you could use the word toxic, I suppose, but I would, you know, I don't like using those catchwords a lot. I try to think through like, okay, what is it we're trying to get at when we use a catchword? Like, you know, why does the university have toxic relationships? And so but oftentimes I wonder if the university is a space where people have difficulty establishing trusting relationships in an intuitive way, right? And so oftentimes I find myself, it's very, very difficult to like establish a relationship with somebody in a way right off the bat where you can kind of feel like, you know, this is somebody who I think I can build trust that with easily over time, right? And you know, it's there's a little bit of a standoffishness, and you know, it really is just like a very competitive environment as well, right? And like, and we're never going to get away from that competitiveness, because that is part of like it, you know, not everyone gets to be a professor, right? So there necessarily has to be a competitive aspect to it. But within a competition, there's things that you're trying to achieve, right? There's goals that you're achieving. And if those goals are just like, you know, pumping out publications and like, you know, on those sorts of levels, then we're going to have people who raise up, who are really have that, like have set their life up in a way where they can be autonomous, super focused, and not be kind of living a life full of like messy, complicated relationships. Right. And so within Indigenous education, I think the goal is it has to be, okay, how do we set up forms of assessment, and how do we set up ways of being able to determine who are the people who are breezy with their relationships, right? Or like, that's not the term I want to use in a more academic sense, like being breezy with relationships. But I think some people are just really actually quite super skilled at like the ability to connect with others and their ability to establish relationships of trust, and also to not like, you know, not get overburdened and like have a sense of like their limits and capacities, and, you know, to create environments for themselves or to create spaces where themselves and the people that they're going to most closely associate with have good relationships with each other, right? So some people just, they frankly have that skill set. And then and it becomes even more important if we really envision the university as a place where, you know what, we have to connect with communities, and we have to bring our talents to the communities. And then communities have to be able to teach us as well. And we have to be able to then modify and rework our, not only our research, but our behavior in light of this kind of ongoing dialogue that we have with communities, right? And so like, how do we then create modes of assessment where we figure out, okay, who are the people who are real good at this, who are capable of having a real, you know, an easygoing time with the ability to build out and create relationships and to navigate relationships when they're complicated and they're messy, right? And so that's for me, ultimately, what mentorship is going to look like in the university is can we like generate new forms of assessment where we're able to, you know, kind of highlight and identify students, but then also can we create forms of teaching and instruction where we help this build out those skills for students as well, right? Because it's not going to be the case that every student and it's going to have those skills kind of like right off the bat. I think some people are a little bit naturals at it, but then some people, it's, you know, they're really, it's their family upbringing, right? Like families can cultivate that in individuals. So then we have to be able to also bring people who haven't had that into those ways of being as well, about like, do you have that ability to know how to connect with others and to set up relationships and to be in situations of dialogue where you like are really truly co-creating things with communities, where it's like, you know, they bring something, you bring something, and then you create new things together, right? And so that is, for me, is the mentorship piece of how we get there.
You seem to have answered both of what she asked originally, but okay. The one thing I was that comes to mind, particularly with students here in the university, is you mentioned earlier when we were in school, pretty much everybody we were in school with for the most part was connected to community, mm-hmm. and so we didn't have a lot. There's a huge wave currently, I feel like, where there's like a ton of students, Indigenous students, who are second generation removed from community. And in order to build that back up, we need to give them the skills, not only to succeed academically, but to also reconnect with community in a good way and reconnect with culture and heritage and practice, mm-hmm. In a good way. And that's part of the, like, one of the things that I love about my job is I have the ability to do that. And then I have colleagues like you where I could turn to for the academic stuff, right? Because I have these students that are blossoming and learning And I get to help them connect with their community. I get to help them figure out where they actually come from and who they really are in terms of, you know, their community. Like, let's find a community that will accept you, because that's really important these days. Like, you know, you're not from Stony Plain. You're from somewhere else. Like, you're
Cuckoo, yeah, Peking, Lake. Over, you know,
let's find that. Yeah. Let's find that map, and let's find your cousins.
yeah.
And then start building those, because it gets to be very uncomfortable out in the real world, I guess you could say, when you have this very well-educated, well-spoken, like, Indigenous student who's out there being the liaison for XYZ company or the city or wherever, but they don't have that connection to community. It's starting to get cringy, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we need to really start to kind of try to develop that as well as part of the academy. And that's where it's important to be able to work with, like, my type of role and professor roles, like community service learning and those types of programs that we have, that we offer.
Yeah.
I feel like that's going to play a bigger role coming up.
Well, and, you know, and obviously there's still an issue of non-Indigenous peoples claiming to be Indigenous too, right? But then it's, you know, but what you're pointing to is that kind of that broader gray area where it's like, you know, people who have some claim to indigeneity, but, you know, haven't really spent a lot of time in communities, right? And so, you know, U of A in some respects is quite good at dealing with this, you know, because they have set up forms for adjudicating these sorts of issues of, like, is this person Indigenous or not, right? And so, like, you know, part of it there is, like, you know, instead of, like, blood, it's kinship. Instead of self-identification, it's citizenship, right? And, you know, for me, part of one of the ways in which I'll bring up this Indigenous density concept again, one of the ways in which I've been thinking about it recently is, okay, so we have this previous concept, authenticity, right? Like, it's like, are you like an authentically Indigenous person? And then people have been critical of that idea for a number of different reasons, right? So, you know, too often with Indigenous authenticity, we just locate it to a few, like, super, like, traditional cultural activities and to be authentic, but not all Indigenous peoples kind of, you know, hit those check boxes, right? And so, you know, so there is a little bit of suspicion around that. But then I think the more damning critique of Indigenous authenticity is it lends itself too easily to kind of a binary thinking. Is like, are you authentic Indian or are you just not Indigenous at all? And in particular, when you have that binary thinking of, like, that are you super Native or are you not Native at all, is that you then set up a hierarchy, right? And then the people who are best at claiming that authenticity then kind of put themselves in a position where they're beyond any sort of critique or criticism, right? And so it's like, whatever they say goes, because they're the, you know, they're the most authentic Native person around. And so they can't be challenged in any sort of way. And that's the, you know, that's what's problematic about authenticity, is that it doesn't allow us to have debate and dialogue over things which are contested, which is, any community is going to contest things all the time. And communities have to be able to do that well and have to have skills and practices that allow, you know, where we're allowed to work through messy, difficult issues together, right? And so, but I do think that, you know, at the end of the day, though, we do, like, there is something about participating in community. People do have to maintain the traditions. People have to maintain the ceremonies. People have to maintain cultural events like powwows and stuff. And we probably should have some sort of way of realizing and like having a respect and honoring people who do that, those sorts of things. Right. And so what I've started to think through it is, like, this idea of Indigenous density. Right. And so it's like, what is the density of your experiences as an Indigenous person? Right. And you might have a bunch of dense experiences around, say, like, maybe you're hunting, or, you know, you participate and help maintain the ceremonies, or, you know, maybe you speak your language, you know, like, there's a bunch of different points. Right. And we can kind of, like, see, like assess a person, like, yeah, no, they have a lot of a density of experiences, right? And so, you know, someone like me, like, I do ceremony, like, but it's, you know, I'm not like a frequent goer of it, and, like, you know, I try to keep on top of the, you know, my language skills, but like, I'm not somebody who is like all in on stuff like that. But then I also have a real density of experiences around like participating in the governance of my community, right? And also being like super committed to thinking about what's Indigenous leadership, what's Indigenous education, and trying to build those out for people and, you know, dedicating my life to that sort of thing, right? And so it's like, I'm not asking someone to treat me as the most authentic Indigenous person of all time, but I want, you know, the density of experience I've built up in some areas, I also want to be, to have that recognized, right? And so it's then a matter of like—
it needs to count as well.
Right? Or, you know, for something like me, like I'm not visibly Native, and so I don't have that experience of like being discriminated against or racism in general society, right? And so, you know, people who are really visibly Native, that is a, that's a density of experience that should be respected and you know, and something that we should honor, right? And so, you know, then I think you can start to see, well, then it's a whole field of where people have different densities of experience, all sorts of different areas, and we can suss, you know, each other out in terms of like having this densities in different areas. But then if you start to see somebody is like, well, it doesn't seem like they have real a density of experience in any area other than like the ability to like claim a, you know, a great kokum or something like that, well, then you start to ask yourself, should this person's like claim to indigeneity be treated as the same as somebody else's? And, you know, I think the simple answer
Should we be reaching out to them to be some kind of expert? And should they be sitting on these boards that the university seems to establish quite often with community members?
Yes.
Yeah. Which is not always there's that authenticity thing, but then there's their density is like very low. You know,
absolutely.
Like, and that's a new way to look at it, because you're sitting there and you're like, who are you to speak on this, because you don't even go here. Just kidding. Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. You know what I mean, though? Like, they're just way out of practice in terms of being Indigenous or whatever you want to, however you want to call it. Their density has lapsed over the past 20 years or something. Absolutely. You know? And that's why I really like this idea.
You're making me think about this, rethink this, you know, this notion of density. It calls to kind of going back to kind of your topic of passion of intergenerational knowledge and leadership and understanding all the different complexity of what that looked like in community, because there would have been also entrepreneurs, there would be philosophers, there would be, so it the density has to consider broadly the range of ways of being and doing and thinking, right, within that context, like the expanded view of that density, but also thinking about like you said, Jackie, it has to count. We have to then imagine, if you're helping us think about what building an Indigenous institution, but Indigenous education has to go then beyond education in the structures of our syllabuses, because it's then that way of leading, like you said, and then the discipline, which is a form of density also. You know, so there's different ranges or different, it's not a checkbox marked up, you know, either, right?
You know, well, it requires people then to have a little bit of a complex understanding of like, okay, well, where does these different forms of Indigenous density exist, right? And so right now, what I think happens with non-Indigenous peoples is part of their interpretive frame of like, can I judge someone as Indigenous? Not is really, it is a binary proposition, right? Is like, this person is either Indigenous and then they're good to fill in any role, or they're non-Indigenous and they're not capable of filling in those roles, right? But as soon as somebody is deemed Indigenous, then there's like the ability for non-Indigenous peoples to have an assessment of like, okay, well, where does this person bring knowledge or expertise, or, you know, where should they be trusted the most? You know, a lot of that I think goes out the window. It's just like, you can just take any Indigenous person and plug them into the need you have. And then that whole other assessment of like, well, what is the talents that they bring? What are the specific skill sets that they bring? And who can they, you know, not necessarily speak on behalf of, but like, you know, sometimes, yes, you're speaking on behalf of, but sometimes it's, you know, also like, who are they connected to, right?
But yeah. Not only who claims you, like your community that claims you, but also do a group of, or not even a group, but do other individual well-known Indigenous people back you up? That's a thing that's overlooked as well, because you need, I feel like you should be supported by not only your community at home, like if you happen to be lucky enough to be from a land-based community, but also just other indigenous leaders and or renowned or well-known people out there who do have that trust of everybody already as well. Like their density has been, you know, proven and they're solid. If those people also support that, the other person, the person that we're in question of, like, not just the fact that they're indigenous and they're plunked into this role, who do they know that supports them as well too, right? In the community.
But to me, something like seeing a person's network and who they're part of, that's only one part of the assessment, right? Because like, I guess part of what I'm asking non-Indigenous peoples to take on is to have a little bit of that interpretive capacity to make these like kind of more complicated assessments where you have to balance a lot of different factors, right? And so, or the, you know, the joke I was always, when I was out in Vancouver, I had a buddy, Mike Fabris, and me and him would always joke if like, if you were super, if someone in your community had a real hate on for you or your family, then you know they're super well connected. And so that's like the sign of being like, you know, really authentic, is that there's people in your community who like really don't like you.
You're totally legit.
Right? If you're like, oh,
if,
yeah.
If people in your community have beef with you, you're legit.
You're good. Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, but I guess, you know, that's part of the bigger thing, right? Is what non-Indigenous peoples, I think they have, what they've tried to tell themselves is that they have an ability to not wade into these debates, right? And to these judgments. And they're like, by now, we'll just respect whatever Indigenous people tell us and we'll go with that. And that's what a respectful relationship looks like. But that can't be, that can never be the case, because we always have, you know, debates and contestations, but also Indigenous communities are really communities of communities all the time, right? There's all sorts of different, like, you know, groupings of people who make a life with each other, right? Who are in relation with each other. And for non-Indigenous peoples, it can't just be a matter of like, well, you know what, they just do their whole little thing across the boundary and then they just tell us what's up and then we follow that, because they're always actively involved in making assessments of what indigeneity is, what communities are, who should get resources, who should get funding. And so non-Indigenous peoples necessarily have to get wrapped up in having that interpretive capacity to think through struggles with us, right? Like, they're never going to do it as good as us or with the same level of knowledge, but the idea that they just like, they absolve themselves from having any sort of interpretive responsibility for the struggles in our community is not sufficient either, right? There has to be a willingness to take these things on.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Cindy and Jackie and Matthew. And just speaking of those threads, Cindy, there are so many different ones to pull on. But one that came up for me, Matthew, is your appreciation for ancestral relations. So, you know, you've been quoted as you know, identifying yourself as a third generation educator and really drawing on the power of your familial legacies and informing how you teach or approach education, and even your master's thesis and presumably your PhD all are bound in relationality. I mean, even the title of your master's thesis was around Miwa Kotuin. And so just in terms of closing thoughts, but really honor for ancestral relations is, do you mind just sharing a bit about your own key learnings or any major understandings that you've come to with regards to like ancestral relations, ancestral governance models, even, you know, the theme of leadership has been reoccurring. And, you know, there's the contemporary neoliberal ideals of individualized leadership compared to like pre-colonial collectivist models of leadership and what that looks like. But yeah, kind of like almost coming full circle to where we started this conversation is, do you mind sharing some of those key learnings with us?
Yeah, you know, for me, when I think about my understanding of leadership and like how you build institutions, there's a big part of it that's intuitive, but then also there's a big part of it that's not. Like, You know, so for me, the most key important part of building institutions is you have to have a goal, a collective goal that people are trying to achieve. And then once you've identified that collective goal, you work towards it, right? So the, you know, I was at a conference recently, and this is an international relations, and relationality is a big thing. In fact, this conference is like a 5,000 person conference. Next year, their theme is relationality, bringing relationality into international relations, right? And so, but the way in which they think about it is so vastly different. For them, relationality is like, how do you access better knowledge about the world, right? And so I went to this panel, and people are like, how do you do it well? Like, you know, how do we get the best version or understanding of relationality? And I'm like, yeah, sure, we could, like, you know, split hairs and get real granular in our analysis and that sort of stuff. But also, it's really not that necessary. Like, you know, relationality is you are a collective, you have a relationship with each other, and you have a goal, and you're trying to achieve that. And then you have to think through the difficulty of what are the decisions and steps we need to take in order to achieve that goal, you know? And that's just like a teaching that has just been passed down to me. And I just think that's kind of like real basic, simple Cree knowledge. Like, for me, one of the reasons why I really like Cree thinking sometimes is people don't overcomplicate it. They're like, no, it's this, you know, you keep it simple, right? And that's, if you keep it simple, then you really help yourself out. And so I think it, you know, it is a level of valuing those intuitions that are kind of built into you through, you know, your upbringing and your family. But I think there's always that ability for us to then take those intuitions and to think through, like, well, what are those intuitions really? Like, what are we trying to achieve, right? Or, you know, like, if I had to describe those intuitions to someone else, can I do it, right? And so, you know, part of the way in which I've been thinking about it recently is like, you know what, for me to be able to describe those intuitions and then to teach them to other people, to help build up other people's leadership capacity and to have that mentoring ability, no, that's honoring those intuitions that have been given to me, because it, you know, it hopefully is spreading what I think are these kind of really important values and practices that my family has built up over generations to others, right? And so maybe I'll just leave it there. And yeah, hi, Nanaskamin. Thanks for having me on. And yeah, it was awesome.
Let's see, Matthew and Jackie, what a great conversation, the beautiful insights and threads that you're leaving all our listeners to sit with, digest, and imagine with you and all your relatives and those who've inspired you to be the awesome, ever deadly arts prop that we get to hang out with today.